Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Ballot to Talk About. It is Sunday, the 16th of October, 2022, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Churn. How are you, Churn?
Well, as we were just sort of discussing before, we're recording this at 9:28 my time, and I just complained I'm sweating, and it's the middle of the afternoon where you are, and you're saying it's a completely opposite reaction. So it's nice if you're on the other side of the world. How about you, Sam?
Yeah, I always do enjoy the fact that we are literally on the other side of the world. So not only are we in completely different time zones, we have completely different climates as well. So yeah, I do enjoy that.
But one thing we can agree before we start was that it was a very good choice of opening song. And I was struggling to think of a Danish song, but Only Teardrops by Emily DeForest. It was the first Eurovision that I started watching. So kudos to that, Sam. And she won it that year, didn't she?
She did indeed. Yeah, I was racking my brain and then I was like, it's got to be Eurovision. So here we are. And it's fitting because Denmark will be going for their snap election in a couple of weeks' time. And that is what we will be discussing for the second half of today's podcast. And we'll be coupling that to start with a discussion about the results from the German state of Lower Saxony, who had their state election last weekend. And, Churn, it was a relatively good result for the governing SPD, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And it's, well, we definitely know one thing, is that the incumbent Minister President Stefan Weil will be returning for a third term. So just to bring everyone up to date with the results, there were 146 seats in the Landtag up for election. Now, these included 11 overhang or levelling seats. So in the last Landtag, there were only 135. This time around, there were 146. So the net change in seats might not be reflective so much of that. It also takes into account the increase in the size of the next parliament. 74 seats are needed for majority. The SPD got 57 seats, which is up 2, with 33.4% of the vote. The CDU have 47 seats, which is down 3, with 28% of the vote. The Greens have 24 seats, which is up 12, with 15% of the vote. And the AfD doubled the number of seats to 18, up from 9 they had previously with 11% of the vote. And the FDP lost all 11 seats that they had previously. Why? Because it fell below the 5% threshold. So in terms of numbers, the CDU lost 3 seats. The FDP wanted to govern the FDP, so that's no longer an option. Minister President Stefan Weil has 2 options, actually. He could continue the grand coalition, which of the SPD-CDU, which we saw in the second Weil government from 2017 to 2022, or he could go back to the first iteration, which was SPD-Greens government, because that has a majority in the Landtag. But before we discuss individually the party's performances and what government we can expect, Sam, your reaction to those results?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting set of results in the context of German politics. And I should preface this in the same way that we preface every discussion about German state elections, in that in Germany, there does often seem to be a distinct divide between state politics and federal politics. But nonetheless, I think it is an interesting environment because we are in a situation where Olaf Scholz's approval rating is very low and seemingly declining. And this was an SPD incumbent government going for re-election. So all in all, it's an interesting case to look at. And to be honest, since early 2021, it's never really felt in doubt that Stefan Weil's SPD would finish first in this election. Although over the summer, it did seem to narrow quite significantly, and that's what we did see on election day with the CDU and SPD relatively close to each other in the final results. But nonetheless, it was the worst CDU result in Lower Saxony in more than 60 years, and amongst the lowest ever vote share for the SPD in their history in the state. So it's not really a glowing result for either of the main parties, despite the fact that it is seemingly obvious for that the SPD's Stefan Weil will remain Minister President after this election. What do you think about it, Churn?
I just think this is such a different contrast. I mean, the last German state elections we talked about, North Rhine-Westphalia and Schleswig-Holstein, let's be honest, rather in the same neck of the woods, isn't it, as Lower Saxony, we saw completely different results. I mean, in Schleswig-Holstein, Daniel Günther fell one or two seats short of absolute majority, a big increase in the CDU vote, and same in Nordrhein-Westfalia. And I often thought that the federal situation had deteriorated for the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, because his party, in the latest opinion poll, showed him coming third behind the CDU and now consistently behind the Greens, which I don't think has happened in the SPD's, well, certain recent history. So, Sam, I'm just curious, when you break down the SPD results, what has changed between May and now? Or is it just because, as you said earlier, it's the fact that Stefan Weil is very popular. In terms of the preferred minister president, he was miles ahead of his CDU challenger. Mm-hmm. So is it just state factors, federal factors, or what do you think?
I think this mainly comes down to state factors because, as you said, Stefan Weil has been a very popular minister president and throughout the entire campaign held roughly a 30% lead over Bernd Altusmann, who was the CDU candidate for minister president in Lower Saxony. So it wasn't even close in terms of who would have been the preferred minister president in the state. And I think the other thing to remember here is that unlike Schleswig-Holstein and North Rhine-Westphalia, this was an SPD incumbent government. And in all three of those cases, we saw incumbent governments retain office. And I think that is key here because Stefan Weil's campaign was dominated by him trying to make it a single issue campaign about confidence vote in the government and confidence that the government could remain stable to combat the cost of living crisis, the energy price crisis, and also to contribute to the German response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So this vote did seem to be a vote for stability in Lower Saxony, and that's why we saw Stefan Weil emerging as a popular candidate, and not least because we actually see Lower Saxony at the heart of some of these energy price crisis talks because it is seen as one of the centres of Germany's federal response to the energy price crisis, because he is seeking to make Lower Saxony one of the energy hubs of Germany, to be the heart of the accelerated energy transition across the country. And Weil has been expanding wind and solar power, is seeking to increase liquefied natural gas import, and is also seeking some new fossil fuel extraction projects in the North Sea. So all in all that combined, it does seem a perfect environment for someone like Stefan Weil to emerge victorious in this campaign, because he is tapping right into the heart of the issues that are going on right now in Germany, which first and foremost is the response to the energy crisis.
And not only that, in terms of, it's also shaped this region, the landscape of German energy policy, because it's also one of the the federal government, this is where one of the last nuclear power plants is in Lower Saxony itself. So back to that fundamental decision 10 years ago, when Angela Merkel said made a sudden declaration that there'll be no more nuclear power plants, this was one of the last who stand. And actually, ironically, it was opposed right now in this election by both the SPD and the CDU, but it's still expected to go ahead. So it's really been at the heart of Germany's changing energy policy more broadly over the last 10 years or so. I also think as well that one thing that I will say about the state elections this year is that links Lower Saxony, Schleswig-Holstein and North Rhine-Westphalia is that the minister president candidate that was by far the most popular went on to win. So in the sense of North Rhine-Westphalia and Schleswig-Holstein, the incumbent CDU minister presidents were by streets ahead the most popular, same as here. And what were the results was that the incumbent governments will return and giving more coalition freedoms and options to choose.
Yeah, I think in summary of what we were saying before, I think it's safe to say that this performance is in spite of Olaf Scholz's difficulties on the federal level, not because of them. And I think it is important to treat these as quite separate to the federal performance, because it does seem if you were mapping federal politics onto this election, you would be expecting the SPD to drop out of government and drop out of government with quite some pace as well.
So now, Sam, the SPD has options, as I mentioned earlier, the Grand Coalition or the Red-Green Coalition, which is traditionally what is preferred. It's surely going to go for its heart desires, isn't it? The Red-Green Alliance.
That certainly seems to be the most likely option, namely because it's actually happened before and under the same minister-president, because between 2013 and 2017, it was an SPD Green government led by Stefan Weil. So he has experience of leading that government. And in 2017, the numbers weren't quite there to continue it, so he chose to go into a grand coalition and has made quite clear since the election that his preference is not to have to do that again. And for even more evidence that I think that's the most likely option, you actually had Julia Hamburg, who was the lead candidate for the Green Party, saying in the immediate aftermath of the election that they would be ready to serve again should Stefan Weil approach them. So I do think that's by far and away the most likely outcome here. And they have the numbers, quite clearly they have the numbers to be able to put together a majority government in this Landtag, and I see no reason why that won't be happening.
I agree. I think it's quite obvious here. And sometimes, you know, the funny thing is that even though we so clearly demarcate that these are state-based reasons why Stefan Weil won, nonetheless, there could still be positive federal press coverage for Olaf Scholz himself, despite the fact that there was no causality between that. So I think, you know, overall, it will be seen as a good result for him.
And think of it this way as well. One of the things the Landtags do is contribute members to the Bundesrat, the upper house in Germany, and this will be a left ticket going into the Bundesrat rather than previous, where they had to send a grand coalition ticket to the Bundesrat, and that will benefit Olaf Scholz.
Indeed, it definitely will be. And the SPD itself actually won two more constituency seats, 57. That's why the parliament had to expand, is because the SPD won more constituencies on a lower share of the vote. And I also note that the Greens also won three constituency seats themselves. So it seems to me very much that that they have picked up a little bit momentum in the constituencies. And even though, and the constituencies in many, even though it's MMP system, I still think that it tells you a very good story potentially about the local support that they have. And so that's something I think is worth noting as well. On the Greens, though, this election, yes, they could be going back in government, but I wonder, Tim, if I look at the opinion polls, I mean, in June 2022, they were polling around 20% of the vote, but yet they finished with, you know, about 15% of the vote in this election. So therefore, it seems to be as well that vote went to the AfD, who experienced a late surge, and I do not think that Green voters went to the AfD. So what could explain it? Do you think the Greens will be a little bit disappointed by these results?
I think the Greens will be a little bit disappointed by this. But what we did see, if you look at the opinion poll trend of this entire campaign, is that when the SPD were falling, the Green were growing. And in the inverse, when the SPD were growing, the Green result was falling. Because I think they share a very similar pool of voters in Lower Saxony and indeed more broadly around the country as well. And I think this also came at a time where the Greens were having a bit of an issue on the national level, which filters down quite nicely, as we said before, because of Lower Saxony's place in the energy debate. Because the Greens on the federal level had been coming under scrutiny for disagreeing with the government's decision to delay the shutdown of the last two nuclear plants in Germany, which made the Greens look like they were becoming a hindrance to energy security heading into the winter. And I think that didn't help them going into this election because of that federal environment. But more broadly, I think the SPD became slightly more popular off the back of Stefan Weil, and they were just taking voters who had, for a temporary period, deserted them in opinion polls to go to the Greens. And I think the story of the AfD is a slightly different story, which is pulling support from all over the political spectrum, and I don't think it is a Green to AfD transfer. That would seem a very unusual thing. What do you think, Chern?
Well, one thing that I do know, however, is that the Greens peaked in the summer. I do think there was crossover. I do notice the SPD vote declined, the Green vote went up. And when the Green vote went down, the SP vote went somewhat up. And I actually think, don't forget, Sam, one event that did take place over the summer, and you and I were attest to this, was the massive heat wave that struck throughout Europe as well. So I would not be surprised if during those summer months, issues related to climate change and how to respond to climate change and the environment were the top of people's minds. And the opinion polls do suggest that if climate change is the most pressing issue and you want to know which is the most competent party, it is the Greens. In a Infotest poll, 43% of people would say that the Greens were the most competent on environmental issues. So to me, I think that it's more a reflection potential of that summer where we saw a record heat wave. And don't forget, Sam, 1 year ago, this region was absolutely devastated by flooding. You had flooding in 2021. The summer of heat just reinforced the entire issue of climate change. And that, to me, contributed to the Greens' rise. Do you buy that theory?
No, absolutely. I think that is a good point to be made. I think ultimately, potentially as well, the point where we saw the Greens at their highest in opinion polls in Lower Saxony also happened to be at a time where the CDU and SPD votes was closer together. And I wonder if some Green voters thought, well, actually, if we vote Green instead of SPD, we maybe end up in a situation where the CDU win this election. And even if the Green and SPD vote combined is higher than that, it would seem more likely that you end up with Bernd Altusmann as the minister president, which is something I think the Green voters who did go back to the SPD didn't want to see happen. And I wonder if that played a role as well.
I think there's a lot of excellent reasons that we both suggested there. One final thought before we wrap up this little section and ask for your reflections on this result is, let's talk about the final party in this national government, which is the FDP. We had four state elections now, and they have no seats in Saarland and Lower Saxony because it fell below the 5% threshold. Half the number of seats in North Rhine-Westphalia and Schleswig-Holstein. I mean, if I was the FDP, I'll be experiencing a bit of deja vu, wouldn't I?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that the FPD leadership is furious about this. I mean, here's a quote from the FDP General Secretary, Bayandir Sarai, who said that the federal coalition can't work if two partners keep coming up with ideas about how to spend more and more money, and the third has to figure out how to finance the whole thing. So these kind of elections, I think, compound the FDP frustration with the federal government. And some people are even suggesting that the FDP officials are blaming their participation in the federal government for this series of bad results. So there is clearly a heck of amount of frustration in the FDP leadership, and it is seeming like history might be repeating itself, and that is maybe where this frustration is coming from.
I genuinely am not surprised that the FDP officials are feeling furious at these results, and it's not only that, it's indicative of a pattern of performances as well. You know, yes, they're all in one area of Germany, but it is becoming consistent. And even in national opinion polls, their vote is slowly going down to the crucial 5% threshold. So, Sam, I feel like I have no other question to ask other than this. Could we see the FDP leave this government and at a federal level, potentially, given this trajectory? Or will they stick it out?
I think it's a difficult question to answer because everything that I know about politics tells me that there is clearly a chance that this government does fall apart, because when you end up in a situation where coalition partners become immensely frustrated about one policy or another, or in fact the whole programme of government, like I'm sure we're going to talk about in the next section of our podcast in Denmark, then they have every right to leave the coalition, collapse the government, potentially trigger a snap election, as happened in Denmark. However, That is not something that historically happens in Germany, and it doesn't happen on the state level, it doesn't happen on the federal level unless something seismically goes wrong. So my gut is to say that this coalition government will last the course through to the next election as scheduled, but that's not to say that along the way there won't be an immense amount of disharmony. And who knows, we might be entering an era of German politics where parties do decide to push the nuclear option and leave the government entirely. But my sense is that no matter how high the frustrations get, I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, for the SPD's perspective, though, their history of dealing, the last time they dealt with the FDP in government was in the 1980s. And what happened? The CDU proposed a vote of no confidence, which was actually supported by the FDP. And that led to the rise of Helmut Kohl as chancellor, where he stayed for 16 years. So the SPD, if they were looking at history, may potentially want to cast slightly more wary eye about that. But I do think for now, it's a lot of frustration, but I don't think that's their will to collapse this government at this point. Potentially in the future, as the winter gets tougher and the war in Ukraine continues to grind on, and there are questions about the level of German support and about energy policy itself, we could see more differentiation. So the ability of Olaf Scholz to get policy to the Bundestag could be more difficult, despite this election in making his situation in the Bundesrat being a bit more interesting. So ironically, he might have solved the problem in the upper house by making it easier, but he could have just made it harder in the lower house for him to pass policy.
So, welcome back to Ballot to Talk About, where we will now be discussing the snap election that has been triggered in Denmark that will be taking place 7 months earlier than scheduled on the 1st of November. Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen will be leading her Social Democratic Party into this election, having formed a minority government in 2019, but supported by three other parties, one of which led to this snap election we'll be seeing now. And I'm sure in a minute, Chern, you'll be telling us the story of how we got here. But one thing that's worth stating straight away, which is what we did discuss last year when we covered Denmark during the Euros football tournament, is that Denmark does have a history of having two distinct political blocks, the red bloc of centre-left parties and the blue bloc of centre-right parties. And this election, a lot of our discussion today will be based around those two blocks, whether they can hold, and who is most likely to benefit from this election taking place. So, Chern, I think the natural place to start with this election is to discuss how we got here.
Yeah, and of all the government collapses we have covered on this podcast, this is one of the ones that has been the most interesting and the most, I think, I'm not sure you're going to tell me, in my opinion, one of the most bizarre, because the cause of it was an animal called a mink. And I had to be honest, I had to Google it to find a picture of a mink, because I've never heard of this animal before. Anyway, the mink is it's a dark-colored mammal, and its fur is highly prized for use in clothing. And one of the biggest countries that produces mink fur is Denmark. Now, during the coronavirus pandemic, minks were one of the animals that were found to be able to be infected with the coronavirus. And it was in transmission from minks to humans was first documented in the Netherlands. Now, in November 2020, the Danish government took a decision to slaughter its basically the entire population of 15 to 17 million animals to stop the spread of so-called cluster 5, which was a mutated strain of the virus and which had been linked to the animals and resulted in infections of 12 humans with this mutated variant. However, this decision was later declared to be illegal, although the law was later changed in support of the action. Now, there was the inquiry into this, which cleared Mette Frederiksen, although there were some deleted text messages involved as well. However, the Social Liberals, which was one of the parties within the Red Bloc, were quite unhappy with all of this. And There had been a lot of speculations over the last couple of months. I remember telling you about Sam that this is one country you potentially had to pay attention for the possibility of a snap election, I think about a month ago, and that has suddenly come up to pass. And the reason is that the social liberals gave Mette Frederiksen an ultimatum that if you do not call an election by this date, that they will call for a vote of no confidence. And so Mette Frederiksen preempted a decision by calling this snap election. And Sam, yes, it is happening on the 1st of November, but if you live on the Faroe Islands, you'll be going to vote the day before on the 31st of October. So there's one small little caveat. Anything would you like to add about why we got to this situation?
No, I mean, I think you summed it up quite eloquently, and it was something that came about relatively quickly in terms of the election being called and the election taking place. But actually, this story has been brewing for quite a while because the upset in the Social Liberals began last year, and actually, the commission report which triggered the eventual calls for a confidence vote was published back in June of this year. So it's basically been raging on for the summer until we got this eventual decision from Mette Frederiksen. But no, absolutely, I think you summed it up well, and it does seem like a rather bizarre series of events to end up with a snap election, especially given the domestic and international context in Denmark. And I'm sure that's something we'll be unpacking as we break down these parties. But Chen, first question I had for you is that we're obviously seeing the premiership of Mette Frederiksen potentially end sooner than she expected. So how do we view that premiership, and how do you think it will be evaluated in this election?
Well, apart from the animal culling, I think she had quite a successful record during the COVID pandemic. In fact, opinion polls had showed that at the beginning of the crisis, and for quite a long period of time, the Social Democrats were polling quite close to 35% of the vote, which will represent an increase of nearly 10 percentage points from the general election. However, since then, it's been slowly been trending downwards for the Social Democrats. I think Mette Frederiksen took over a party that she has implemented some welfare policies as well, but equally for a Social Democratic Party. And I think crucial to how, as well, the Swedish Social Democrats Party was able to maintain its dominant position, although it lost government, is the fact that it's suddenly on immigration policy, it shifted very much towards the far right and adopted a lot of the policies championed by the far right Danish People's Party. And in fact, heading into this election, Mette Frederiksen over her term struck a deal with the Rwandan government. Now, UK listeners will remember that a bit more, that country a bit more clearly, because the UK government tried to strike a similar deal to deport asylum seekers from the UK to Rwanda. And in Denmark, that's something Mette Frederiksen has been also trying to achieve as well. So I think it is notable of a type of Scandinavian leader, Social Democratic Scandinavian leader, who is a more liberal potentially on welfare policy than traditional Social Democratic parties that governed in the past, but on the question of immigration and asylum seekers, very much on the right. What do you think, Sam?
Yeah, and I think there's a nice comparison here to be drawn to the outgoing Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson, particularly on foreign and defence policy, because she coordinated cross-party discussions in the aftermath of the Russian invasion, which presented the National Compromise on Danish Security Policy, which included a 7 billion Krona emergency allocation to defence and a sizable upgrading in Danish defence spending. And also, interestingly, on a foreign policy perspective, they decided to hold a referendum in June on the cancellation of the EU defence opt-out that Denmark has held for decades. And it was a landslide yes vote to abolish the opt-out of the European Common Security and Defence Policy. So, in the same way that Magdalena Andersson transformed Swedish defence policy, it seemed that Mette Frederiksen, in the aftermath of the Russian invasion, has also done the same in Denmark as well. So in that way, she has also been able to be a ideologically flexible Prime Minister of Denmark, responding to international events. And I think that is something she's demonstrated quite successfully, particularly in the last 12 months.
And just a quick note is that one of the news that has happened over the last 48 hours is that the Tilda agreement in Sweden has been struck, which is the agreement struck by three centre-right parties, the moderate party led by Ulf Kristersson, the Christian Democrats and the Liberals, and for a coalition government that will rely on support from the far-right Swedish Democrats. Now, there is some consternation with the Liberals, within the Liberals, about how much they had to give. And so, therefore, I suspect that Swedish politics will be very interesting over the next 4 years. And you can follow that discussion on our Twitter page at @ballot_talk, where we'll keep you up to date on Swedish politics. But you mentioned the defense referendum. Just quickly, two more facts that I thought were very interesting. It's actually the first time that Denmark has ever abolished one of the EU's opt-outs. So this is really historical stuff. And it was the largest share of the vote ever recorded by the yes side, the EU referendum. So clearly, the war in Ukraine has fundamentally altered the fault lines in Denmark in regards to its relationship with Europe. So, and this is definitely one of them. And ongoing as well is that Denmark is the focal point for the two pipelines carrying gas from Russia to the Nord Stream 1 and 2, which suffered some damage over the last couple of weeks as well. So we can expect in the background that although defense and security issues are not the driving force of people's votes, it is certainly, would you not agree, Sam, one of the factors that shapes people's perception in this election, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that's a good bridge to talk about the red bloc led by the Social Democrats going into this election, because it was a party within the red bloc that caused this election. So I guess one of the key questions to ask is, are they going to benefit from deciding to push for this election at one, the red bloc as a whole, two, the Social Democrats, and three, the Social Liberals who caused it?
Well, I suppose we mentioned this before, Sam, Turkey's voting for early Christmas, which was what James Callaghan used to describe the SNP when they triggered when they voted in favor of the vote of no confidence in 1979. And to a large extent, you know, that could certainly be applied to the Social Liberals, because they secured 8.6% of the vote. The opinion poll suggests the party has been hovering between 4-5%. So it doesn't seem to be a good time now to be a Social Liberal. But I think the wider, bigger question is, will they deviate from the red bloc, which I think it will be more concern for the Social Democrats? And I think the answer is that despite triggering the snap election, I don't think the answer is that they will leave the red bloc, because the alternative within Denmark, which is a very static in terms of which parties move within, that if parties are in the red bloc, they are very loyal to the Social Democrats. If parties are in the blue bloc, they're very loyal to the leading party that emerges within it. And I do not see at this stage a Social Liberal supporting a blue bloc which contains several far-right parties in it. And I think that will go down very badly with its voters as well. I do know, however, and it's something that we did text earlier this week, is that ever since Mette Frederiksen called the snap election, and I think it's crucial as well, because Mette Frederiksen's hand was forced into the snap election. She didn't want it. And I think that's key in terms of the messaging. It is not somebody trying to take political advantage. It is someone being forced into this situation. Is that the Social Democrats, which were kind of neck and neck in the opinion polls, have inched ahead in latest opinion polls. So, but then again, Sam, as we saw with the Swedish Social Democrats, is that a question of the votes coming from other red bloc parties, or more importantly for them, the votes coming from the more centrist blue bloc parties? And I don't think that has been answered yet. What do you think, Sam?
No, I mean, I saw an opinion poll actually that came out this morning of the Danish election, and it almost looked like a poll that we saw from the Latvian election, which we covered a few weeks ago, because it looked like there were going to be only two parties above 10% and the rest of them under 10%, with the Social Democrats miles ahead of everybody else. So I think one of the key stories to look out for in this election is going to be not necessarily the performance of the Social Democrats, but the performance of their allies, and whether their allies can accumulate enough support to tip the red bloc over the edge in this election. At the moment, the red bloc are marginally ahead of the blue bloc as a whole, but crucially that relies on them actually sticking together as a red bloc, which I agree with you. I think the Social Liberals are more likely to remain supportive of a Mette Frederiksen government, but it wouldn't be the first time that they didn't support the Red Bloc, because actually they were part of a conservative-led coalition government as recently as 1988 under the only conservative Prime Minister, Paul Schluter. So it wouldn't be the first time that they've gone across the floor, but I don't think that's going to happen. But as I said, I think the Social Democrats can do as much as they want to boost their own vote, but ultimately, as Magdalena Andersson saw in Sweden, if your allies aren't coming with you in growing their support, you could find yourself moving back into opposition. And one more thing, based on what you said about the Social Democrats going into this election not wanting the election, I thought one of the key things that illustrates Mette Frederiksen's entire campaign in this election is a quote she said as she began the Social Democratic campaign, where she said, "I think it's peculiar to hold an election in the middle of an international crisis, a security crisis, an energy crisis, and an economic crisis." And sometimes that kind of argument, although it sounds like I didn't want to be here, so I'm going to have to go along with it, I think it does chime with the public, because one thing we have learnt in the UK as well is that when the public are forced to go to the polls in an environment where they think, why on earth are we doing this, it does tend to benefit the parties who feel like they were dragged into it rather than the parties who initiated it in the first place.
And I think one thing to add about what will be key in this election is, don't forget, Denmark's electoral threshold of 2%. And which parties fall above and below that 2%, I think will be very keen to determine which of the parties in the number can form the numbers in the folk thing itself. So parties such as the Christian Democrats are, you know, at 0.9% of votes. So that's bad news for the Blue Bloc. However, the Alternative is at 1.9%. That's bad news for the Red Bloc. And even, and this could be a crucial pivot to talk about the Blue Bloc parties, is the Danish People's Party is hovering very close to that 2% threshold. Now, Sam, you know, I can remember when we talk about this party, you know, in 2015, we talked about this party achieving second place. What on earth has happened to it? It's quite a dramatic fall from grace for this party, isn't it?
Yeah, I think in this election in particular, they are struggling to compete with a relatively new party on the Danish bloc, which is the party of former immigration minister Inger Støjberg, which is the Danish Democrats. And for some context of this party, the reason she's former immigration minister is because she was actually sentenced to jail time for ordering the illegal separation of refugee couples, and has completely stolen the limelight in Danish politics on hardline immigration policy. And that used to be one of the bastions of the Danish People's Party. In fact, the whole party grew out of wanting to push other parties to move towards a more hardline immigration stance, which they did, because as we discussed in the 2019 election, Mette Frederiksen's Social Democrats went into the election with a more hardline immigration policy. So it's a twofold problem, I think. They did successfully push other parties, therefore the argument became less dominated by them. And then the final nail in the coffin this election around is there's a shiny new kid on the block, which is doing what they did, but in a more contemporary and resonant way than they ever managed to do it, and which is, I think, just finally erasing them from the Danish national political scene. And they've just completely been crowded out, and their USP is no longer a USP.
Yeah, maybe that's the ultimate compliment to the party, is that its entire policy position, or one of its signature policies, has been adopted by its opponents, isn't it? That's what Mrs. Thatcher would sometimes argue one of her greatest achievements was the Labour Party, because in order to get back into power in 1997, is that they had to fundamentally change who they are. And they could certainly, I think, was the cause of the Social Democrat shift to the right on migration and asylum policy. Although on the migration asylum policy issue, I do think it'd be interesting to see how the Social Democrats approach that in the next 4 years. Because just recently, the Red-Green Alliance and the Social Liberals themselves have opposed the so-called potential deal with Rwanda. Now, I do note that in this campaign, Madrid Fredrickson has said less about immigration policy itself compared to 2019, when she was so successful in holding the Social Democratic vote or gaining some of it back from the far right. So I think that it will be interesting to see how the center left potentially approaches this. Will Metric Fredrickson still maintain a hard line, or will the center with the suddenly the red green alliance are polling a lot better? Is will they have more clout and therefore be able to change its immigration policy, and how that will consequentially affect far right politics, and which far right politics will be very interesting to add, will be very interesting to see, sorry. I think one final thing I would add as well is that this is kind of thing with populist parties, isn't it? The shiny new toy does appear and everyone gets moved on to it. It's kind of like, it reminds me, Sam, I'm not sure if you agree, with the Brothers of Italy's rise, is that 5 years ago, we saw the League Party really be that right-wing populist party. But then, attention very soon shifted afterwards to a new party in the bloc, which had not been in government, whereas, of course, Liga was in government. The Danish People Party supported Lars Løkke Rasmussen's last government. And now, Inger Støjberg's new party is the all new thing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It does seem to be an age-old story in when we discuss populist parties. But the Danish Democrats are not the only new kid on the block in the more centre-right sphere in Denmark, are they? Because one of the big stories, particularly in the last few weeks, as this campaign has just got started, has been the re-emergence of former Prime Minister Løkke Rasmussen.
Well, you say that he is part of the blue bloc, but I think the story is a little bit more complicated, isn't it, Sam? Because the story of Lars Løkke Rasmussen is very interesting. Now, he was a former
Well,
leader
note that
of
I
the.
said on the centre right rather than in the blue block, because I'm sure you're about to say that is the key question.
Yes, and I think what he does is very interesting. Now, he, of course, I'm sure as we discussed in our Euros podcast, was the former prime minister who led the Liberal Party until he was beaten in 2019 by Mette Frederiksen. Now, on election night, he proposed the forming of a new centrist coalition government consisting of himself, the cult conservative party in the Blue Bloc, and the Social Democrats and the Social Liberals to form a centrist government, which was swiftly rejected by Frederiksen at the time because the Red Bloc by far then had the biggest numbers. That position of trying to break the traditional mold of red and blue blocs fundamentally was why he was rejected by the Venstre leadership and was forced to resign. Now, as a result of that, he has subsequently left the party and formed the Moderates, and which is specifically trying to challenge the established red and blue bloc. And ironically, he pointed to immigration policy as the reason and the fact that the red bloc had to shift to accommodate the far right votes as reasons for trying to form this vanguard or centrist coalition to sort of keep the extremes out of power, both the extreme left in the Red Green Alliance and the far right Danish People's Party. So he's really trying to break that mold of Danish politics. But I have to admit that, yes, right now he's doing quite well at 6%. But if the Red Bloc itself falls a couple of seats short, and the blue bloc is a few seats short behind it, and he forms a balance of power position, he will still have to be painted, if you not agree, Sam, with either going for the coalition of the centre-right parties, including Venstre, which kicked him out of the party leadership, or to be forever tainted with the red bloc and by supporting Madrid Fredrickson. So, although his aims are quite good, Sam, I'm not sure, do you think he'd be successful in breaking the mold of Danish politics?
I don't know. I don't know is my question, is my honest answer, because I think it does ultimately depend on how these results pan out. Because if the Red Bloc can form a government without him, I don't think he will necessarily play a significant role in Danish politics at all. But as you said, if there are a few seats short, I could see him potentially going to support Mette Frederiksen's party. And interestingly, I have found it fascinating that Mette Frederiksen repeatedly in this campaign has said that she would really love to form a more centrist, cooperative type of government, which brings upon a breadth of parties. And interestingly, whenever questioned about it, it's not been explicitly just about bringing the Red Bloc parties into a formal coalition. So, because my initial response to this was, I wonder if Mette Frederiksen would even bring Rasmussen on board, because The 2019 election was defined by a contest between Rasmussen and Fredriksson. So, but we've seen in this campaign, I think, a suggestion, albeit a subtle one, that potentially Mette Frederiksen is interested in that if Rasmussen does ultimately decide to support them.
Well, I think, like I say, it will very much depend on how the seats fall as well. But he suddenly, I think, showing that his type of politics is not Sam, that wanting to break the traditional mold, certainly kind of reminds me of this centrist populist ideas. It's kind of a bit like the five-star movement in Italy again. I know we keep drawing the Italian comparisons. We just had the Italian election, so this keeps coming to me. But as this new force in centrist, but it's trying to propose something radical in the country, something new to attract voters. And so far, it seems he's been able to garner a little support. And depending on how the numbers fall in this next election, I think he could be poised to play a big role or no role at all. I think that is either a lot to gain or virtually nothing at all. And I think that, to me, is the most fascinating part of Lars Løkke Rasmussen's political project, I will say. And I think that is something that we'll be watching in over the weeks of the election campaign left.
Yeah, I mean, it has meant, really, on the right, on the centre-right of Danish politics, unlike in previous elections, it's not been entirely clear who the main person you should be paying attention to is, because traditionally it's been whoever has been the leader of the Liberal Party has been the natural other candidate to be Prime Minister. But in this time, it's not exactly that straightforward, is it?
No, it's not. The Liberals are currently now led by Rasmussen's former Environment and Food Minister, Jakob Ellemann-Jensen. However, his poll rating since he took over the leadership has been one in decline. I mean, to just give you a bit of context, in the 2019 election, the party did very well, actually. It came second with 24% of the vote. However, an average of opinion polls now put it at just over 12.8% of the vote, half of that. And it seems that the story is that a lot of it seems to have gone to the Conservative Party, which is led by the former Justice Minister in the Rasmussen government, Soren Pape Poulsen, who, if successful, if the Blue Bloc is successful, and if he comes out first, I suspect, he will probably be the first openly gay Denmark prime minister in Denmark's history. Now, his rise, however, has been slightly checkered because he has been involved in a scandal which has dented trust in his leadership, and it revolves around his husband, Jorge Menendez Vasquez Poulsen, who was discovered that he had no biological relationship to the former president of the Dominican Republic, whom he claimed as an uncle. And the conservative leader has admitted he was wrong to say he held meetings in 2018 with government policies, politicians in the Caribbean country without informing or consulting the Danish foreign ministry. So that his whole idea of trust has been totally dented itself. But Sam, what is fueled in your mind the fall in support for Venstre and the rise in support of Soren Poulsen? And I do note that this scandal doesn't seem to have dented the conservative support, but it might have stopped its rise in its track. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the reasons is that Soren Pape Poulsen has been quite a successful leader of the Conservative Party. It's a new form of modernization of the party. He's a charismatic, as you said, he would be the first gay prime minister. And for a party that has historically voted persistently against marriage equality to now have a divorced gay leader of the party suggests there has been a certain modernization going on. And I think that's been quite attractive to people on the center right who don't necessarily aren't bedded in liberal supporters. They just want to support the person of the Blue Bloc who is most likely to be able to lead the Blue Bloc into government. And I think for a lot of people, it seemed like Soren Pape Poulsen is better positioned to do that. And in fact, Soren Pape Poulsen, until recently, has had consistently better approval ratings than Jakob Ellemann-Jensen, the current Liberal leader. But the reason I feel like that churn has been less clear in recent weeks is because both of them are significantly less popular than Mette Frederiksen. So this doesn't at the moment feel like it's an actual contest for who's going to be prime minister between Ellemann Jensen and Paulsen, because really it seems obvious to everybody who's looking at it that Mette Frederiksen is by far and away the most popular candidate to be prime minister. And I think that's why the Liberals and Conservatives, both of which have struggled to completely take over the other, because it's not entirely clear which is better positioned to take on Mette Frederiksen, because all opinion polls would suggest that neither of them.
In fact, I saw a recent opinion poll on preferred leadership. The person who came in second in terms of preferred prime minister was Lars Løkke Rasmussen, not even Jakob Ellemann Jensen. And for long-time followers of Danish politics, the Ellemann Jensen name is very familiar indeed. He not only was, as the leader himself, was a minister, but his father was a former leader of Venstre. So, and his successor, ironically, Ulf Ellemann Jensen's successor as Venstre leader was somebody called Andreas Rasmussen, who then became Secretary General of NATO. So a little bit of a fun fact there. So his father was a Minister for Foreign Affairs for a very long time, 11 years as Foreign Minister. And his grandfather was also in the Folketing itself. So it's quite a prominent political family. So it's not as if he's going to struggle for name recognition, certainly in terms of his last name. But yes, I do think this struggle between people who are not sure whether they prefer Ellemann Jensen more or Søren Pop Poulsen and more is kind of reflected in the fact that both parties are kind of stuck and have been engaging in this tussle for second place, which we've seen in the polls over the last few months, isn't it?
Mm. I mean, finally, Chern, a question that I think is going to be quite difficult to answer, but what do you think is going to happen in this election? And as a bonus to that, do you think the Conservatives have managed to successfully displace the Liberals as the second largest party in Denmark in this election?
Okay, there are easy predictions to be made, thank God, because I think trying to predict the final red or blue blocks will be a bit difficult. And I think the first prediction, I'm sure you're not going to have no complaints, but it's that the Social Democrats will come first. I think Mette Frederiksen will come first. And I genuinely will not be surprised if she comes first with an increased share of the vote, which is extraordinary because the party in the last two elections that it went into trying to get a second term will be increasing its share of the vote. And it's increased its share of the vote in every election since 2011. So I think that is quite interesting and quite a phenomenal achievement. I think the Conservatives, it's a difficult one because I just wonder if can they perform to the same level of its opinion polls? We have seen that parties on the rise. I mean, just look, we talked about Quebec last week, where the Conservative Party there fell a bit below. Is whether it can get its voters who have newly transitioned to it all out for the polls. I'm not quite convinced by that. So I'm genuinely not sure. But in terms of which party, which block of parties will be biggest, I actually think the fall in the social liberal vote, which is quite significant, and the fact that the Social Democrats, the Red Greens, and the Socialists have not really increased its vote by enough could mean that it might fall one or two seats short, but ahead of the blue bloc. And I do think Lars Løkke Rasmussen will come into the conversation. So that is my opinion. I think is that the red bloc will be probably the bigger of the two blocs than the blue bloc. But the question remains is, will Lars Rasmussen play a prominent role? And I think my answer is yes. What do you think, Sam?
Yeah, I tend to agree with you there. I think ultimately the red bloc will finish as the largest bloc, but I can see them narrowly being able to, once you include the regionalist parties that also make up the red bloc outside of the main four we've discussed today, I think the red bloc might just sneak a majority, and they might even be bang on it. And that's because I think that the increase in the Social Democratic vote and also the slight increase, an emphasis on slight, of the vote of the Socialist People's Party and Red-Green Alliance might just offset the losses of the Social Liberals to mean that Løkke Rasmussen might come into the conversation as bolstering their position, but is not going to be key to whether Mette Frederiksen remains Prime Minister or not. That's my prediction. But I did think the same thing was going to happen in Sweden, and look exactly where we got, which is, and there could be strong parallels there, because Magdalena Andersson and Mette Frederiksen's position is very similar, which is that their party, as an individual party, is set to perform quite well in this election, but their entire future in government is dependent on the performance of the parties they need to prop them up. And ultimately, Mette Frederiksen's allies might fall short, but my sense at this stage is that they might just do enough to have the numbers.
And I think one thing we have to also consider as well is every seat counts. So let's not forget the 2 seats up for election in the Faroe Islands and the 2 seats up for election in Greenland. It could be that close, isn't it? Where we have to turn to regional parties, not 4 in Denmark, to see whether the red bloc can get over the line itself. In fact, I would not be surprised if that is the case, to be honest, if it's one of them that pushes it over the line. So it is a case of every single vote counts, isn't it?
Yeah, and lest we forget the fact that the threshold exists, which could make an enormous difference to which parties are actually available to provide numbers. But anyway, I think that is a good place to end this discussion on Denmark, and we will be back to review the results after the election takes place on the 1st of November. But for now, that is it for the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. There won't be a podcast next weekend, so do join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will be doing a bumper preview of the US midterm elections. And in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook @ballot_talk. And please leave us a rating or review, or simply tell your friends about us. My name is Sam, and until next time, we'll speak to you soon.
See you on the next one.